Welcome and thanks for joining the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I'm your host, Isaac Radansky, founder and CEO of Adventure Media, one of New York's fastest and hottest digital advertising agencies. As always, I'm joined by Patrick Gilbert, Adventure Media's executive director, and today we're bringing you an exciting recording that we did a couple weeks ago with David Sable. David Sable, for those you don't know, is the former global CEO of Young & Rubicam. At the time that David was the CEO, Young & Rubicam was the largest advertising agency in the world with over 180 offices worldwide. And David is now special advisor to WPP. He is a close friend of mine. He is an enormously valuable advisor to our agency. And our relationship with David has had a huge impact on our growth, our strategic thinking, and our approach to clients. And it was a huge honor that we got to sit down with him and New York Festivals as part of their Creativity from the Other Side series of lectures. If you're not familiar with New York Festivals, definitely check them out. They're inspirational. The work they do with agencies and small businesses and the broader advertising community is really incredible. And specifically check out their Creativity from the Other Side series, which is hosted by David Sable. And it's a real honor that they invited us to be a part of it. So you're in for a treat. We talk about media buying. We talk about agency growth. We talk about how advertising and digital advertising has changed over the years. And we just talk about human-to-human selling, because that's what it all comes down to. So buckle in. You're in for a treat. And here goes.
You know, there's a lot been written about media, about advertising, about media. Advertising is down, and yet it seems like media is being bought at tremendous rates. I don't mean money. I mean just like rate of purchase. Like people are buying media all over the place. What's going on?
There's a lot going on. And I think it starts off with taking a step back and looking at it at a higher level. If you're sitting, I mean, this is a phenomenon that most of us have seen to some extent. If you're watching the news, the perspective that you're going to get on world events, world affairs, business, tends to be drastically different than if you walk down Main Street and you just watch people living their everyday lives. So I fell victim to the same hoopla in the media in the beginning. And I felt like, well, advertising's done. Time to sell Adventure Media for parts because it's all over from here. And we did, and I'm not downplaying, like we did lose 30% of our clients in the first few months because these were clients whose businesses themselves were shut down. Seminars, schools, healthcare providers on the other side of it. Like there were some healthcare providers that did really well, other ones not as well, some in the real estate market. Since then, some of those clients have come back and some not, but regardless, the majority of businesses were still operational. People were just like, this is a separate conversation, but unbelievably resilient. I think that the pandemic showed on one hand that people are very sensitive to an invisible enemy, a disease. I'm not an epidemiologist or a virologist, but that's a scary thing. But also it showed that people are unbelievably resilient.
Human beings. Epidemiology very well, very impressive.
Thanks. But people are just like really wildly resilient. And turmoil brings out the best in a lot of people, our ability to pivot and to improvise and to be creative. I think a lot of people probably, talking about creativity, I'd venture to guess a lot of people who didn't think they were that creative up until the beginning of 2019 discovered that they had a lot of creativity, or 2020 discovered that they had a lot of creativity within them that came out. So that all that's to say, people still bought media because people still had things to sell and they still had consumers who were interested in buying products. There's also been the creation of a lot of interesting opportunities that in the last few months or the second part of 2020 have been capitalized on. For example, Facebook CPMs. They went from in November of 2019, you know, at about an average $2 CPM worldwide. And once you break it down by country, the CPMs drastically change. Like in the US, that CPM might be $7, $8 on average. But bundled worldwide, Facebook CPMs are around $2. Whereas in March, we're looking at an 80 cent average CPM worldwide. So a significant drop, you know, more than 50% decrease. That's because a lot of large advertisers pulled out. A lot of companies, you know, they sort of just put a moratorium on spending across the board while things settled. And hundreds, if not, you know, tens of thousands of small businesses leveraged and capitalized on these opportunities. Patrick calls them arbitrage opportunities, which is true, where things that used to cost more now cost less, and the advertisers win on the margins below market rate for clicks and impressions. And that fueled, right? Like the pulling out, like the larger businesses that sort of paused their spending because they're beholden to investors and to boards, so on and so forth. It's sort of a more of a bureaucratic process. They pause spending, just a wave. And this is interesting about digital media. Probably if you go back to the days of television and radio and you know, it takes a month to buy a deal and to negotiate a deal with someone you know working at Time Warner or whatever it may be. Now you could open up a Facebook account and within 15 minutes you could be advertising where North Face used to be advertising. North Face paused their budget either because of the pandemic or because they're boycotting Facebook. Now 5,000 small businesses could jump in within 15 minutes and buy those impressions at a cheaper rate.
And so what's happened to the CPM since then? So they went down to 80 cents in March. The bottom kind of fell out. And now you have all these little companies jumping in to buy. Where do the CPMs sit today?
So the CPMs haven't been driven back to the pre-pandemic levels yet. And I still think there's opportunity. And Facebook, Patrick could talk more about what we've been seeing specifically on Facebook. But they're rising. They're rising slowly. And this is what happens. Like this sort of is proof positive that digital advertising is not run by evil people in high castles extracting money at gunpoint from advertisers. There might be some evil people involved in digital marketing and some of the larger tech companies, but fundamentally it's an open market system. And you see, if you look at a graph over the last year, you're seeing the dynamic of what an open market system looks like. There's an auction placed, there's different advertisers who bid different amounts based on their business outcomes that they're expecting, based on the CPAs that they want, based on the performance goals and the performance targets that they need for their profitability, and the highest bidder wins. It's a little bit more complex than that, but essentially that's how these Google, and Facebook, Instagram.
And what are you seeing in streaming video and broadcast? Where is CPM sitting?
So that's interesting. That's an interesting place. I'm more familiar in the streaming video world. And CPMs there also dropped. So we were talking to Roku, one of the directors, the director of sales for Roku a while ago. And Roku is not just Roku. Roku reaches, like, you know, the ESPN app and lots of other streaming partners of theirs. CPMs, they vary greatly depending on the type of media buy you're purchasing, whether you're purchasing local or national, if you're purchasing specific apps. And then as you layer audiences, so let's say I want to buy the East Coast or a few different, you know, typical geographical regions, DMAs they're called, but I also want to only target men. That's going to raise my CPM. And then I also want to only target people who have placed a sports bet in the past year. That's going to raise my CPM because Roku knows it's not as if like those people are more expensive. Like they don't, like individuals don't put a price on the cost to reach them. Roku knows that if you're targeting a more narrow audience, it's a more valuable audience to you, so they could charge you for it. That's the way the business runs. So those CPMs will increase. But CPMs in general across these media campaigns have dropped a little bit because it's sort of been two different things happening at once. The pandemic, so a lot of advertisers pulling out, and the traditional advertisers that have pulled out are typically the ones that do have large TV budgets, right? So it's not as if the small business, the small e-commerce shop is spending on TV as it is. It's the large bureaucratic publicly traded enterprises that put a moratorium on spending. Those are the ones that hurt TV. So TV saw a drop in spending, but also there's a general decline in TV value over the last 10 years. It hasn't been as pronounced as people always expect it to be. TV is still huge. And you know, people who are in the digital world, they discount TV, but it's huge. But those two things sort of precipitated a drop in CPMs.
And
but
what about availability?
Availability is an interesting one too. It plays into the audience characteristics that you want to target. But overall, we're seeing more availability and networks being willing to make deals faster. So, for example, you know, pre-pandemic, it's like, well, you want this, this, and that. Okay, next month or next quarter, you need to plan. Like, they like to plan a quarter in advance if you're buying TV. Now we were speaking to Roku. It was the second week of December. They're like, you know, if you guys get this going, we could fill this inventory of a $200,000 by the end of the year. We could do it. We'll fill it for you. And traditionally, a lot of television buys would be run of network. Like, they would fill. You would say, okay, here's ideal. I ideally want to target New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut during the daytime on Judge Judy. That's what I want. Okay, so they'll sell that to you, but if you want to get a guaranteed number of impressions, in the contract it'll say anything we can't fill on Judge Judy during prime time is going to be run of network, which means maybe in the middle of the night, maybe on a cooking show, maybe somewhere else, and there'll be like a percentage, 15% typically. Right. You know, allocated to run of network buying, where we're seeing less of that now. And especially with OTT, with streaming television, that's less of an issue because run of network's not really a thing, or maybe it's sort of like a holdover terminology, but it just refers to maybe being shown in other apps or on other platforms.
So are you seeing any particular bargains in the media side?
Patrick, what do you think about specific bargains that we've seen?
The bargains are being identified at the long tail. And what I mean by that is, David, earlier you asked about Facebook CPMs. It's hard to specifically say. When you say Facebook, do you mean a placement on Facebook desktop, or do you mean the Facebook ecosystem, which includes Instagram, it includes Facebook stories, it includes like Facebook audience partners? And that's the way that I view a Facebook ad buy and a CPM in that regard. So we're seeing across the board within our accounts and then other reporting tools and data that we can look at that number has come down, but it's in aggregate and it's on average. So there's two things that are happening. More advertisers have embraced a more liquid type of ad buying, meaning they're not just exclusively buying Facebook placements now. They are more willing than ever before to show the ad placements on Instagram stories and Facebook audience networks and all these other areas, which those naturally will be cheaper. So if you're looking at a click on Facebook that might cost you $2 and another click on elsewhere that costs a dollar, your average click cost per click is $1.50. So that's where we're really seeing that number come down. I don't think it's impacted as much as a decrease amount of budgets being spent. I think that there's two factors. I think there's more inventory that people are giving themselves access to. And there's also a dramatic increase in ad inventory. The reason that some of these Roku ad buys have come down is because people are streaming video more than ever before. People are spending more time on Facebook and just generally on the internet than they have ever before. And this is a trend that started at the beginning of the pandemic, but goes through the roof around holiday time. And that's why there's a lot of questions that we get from e-commerce clients around, you know, what happens between Black Friday and the end of the year. You know, there's this big surge, and then there's like a leveling off during holiday shopping. And then when shipping time cut off, like what happens then? And the real answer is those prices, the inventory really, I mean, I've seen it almost stay static because of the fact that it really is such a factor of eyeballs on the internet and the demand meeting supply of those eyeballs. So that's kind of where we're seeing the...
But the supply, technically, the supply is infinite.
The supply is infinite. Well, I mean, you hopefully have people on the other side looking at these ads.
Yeah, but right? The supply is technically
theoretically it's infinitely scalable as long as people continue to use. And that's, I think, what Patrick's saying is a really brilliant point, because there seem people getting into digital advertising or specifically performance marketing, they feel it's like a black box, difficult to understand, data analytics, click CPMs. But it's fundamentally works along the supply and demand curve. So, you know, if there's a huge increase in people using Facebook, there's going to be a quick increase in supply, and the price is going to drop.
Naturally, you expect more advertisers to bring more of their budgets there, which then kind of regulates the price. And it happens, I mean, going back to Isaac's point, it happens faster now than it ever had been before. People aren't planning these things a month or a quarter in advance. And if you look at it, going back to one of your earlier questions, David, going back 100 years, advertising investment has roughly tracked GDP dollar for dollar. their advertising investment has basically been about 1% of overall GDP in the United States for about 100 years. And that includes across two world wars and oil shocks and a global pandemic. So it's really just we're seeing in aggregate, you know, we're seeing the big brands report lower advertising numbers, but we're just not realizing the real time shift in where those marketing budgets are being spent, because they are being spent in more or less the same way that they were. We're not factoring in the amount of money that's being invested in influencer marketing. A lot of ad budgets are now being spent in that area. And influencer marketing is projected to be a $23 billion market by 2025. So these are the things that aren't as abundantly clear when you read the headlines on the Wall Street Journal. Right. But at the micro level, when you're actually talking to business owners and brand managers, these budgets are being spent. They're just being spent a little bit differently, and these they're being more flexible and adjusted in real time.
But I also suspect, and I'm curious if you think this is true or not, I suspect that there's more small money in the market than ever before.
Absolutely.
So a lot of that small money is making, I think you said that before, just you're seeing it on Facebook, but we know that, you know, the Facebook faux boycott was almost a failure because all the big advertisers represent maybe 4%, 5% of Facebook's advertising, and all the money that they're bringing in is coming from smaller businesses that most of us have never heard of, except we see them all the time in our Facebook. Like, I can't remember the last time I saw in my feed something from a major advertiser. But all day long, I've got, you know, everything from, you know, pills to shoes.
It's so true.
Shaving to whatever the hell it might be.
I'll elaborate on that. So to your point, I'm just trying to pull up these numbers so I actually have them. But
that's
traditionally,
what I love with you guys, because like you actually know what you're talking about.
So yeah. The top 200 advertisers in the U.S., and this is a quote from Ben Thompson of Stratechery, 80%. Of television advertising, as per, I think, 2015, 80% of television advertising was, that revenue was generated from the top 200 advertisers. The exact opposite exists on Facebook, where the top 100 advertisers on Facebook are less than 10% or less than somewhere in that 4 or 5, like somewhere in that range. So more than 80%, to your point, David, more than 80% of Facebook's ad revenue is being come from the long tail small advertisers that are spending a few hundred bucks, a few thousand dollars every single month. And what actually happens then, this boycott actually proved to be the exact opposite of what people expected. We can actually now see that Facebook had a net increase in advertising revenue over Q3, which is the exact opposite of what people expected.
But not the opposite of what Zuckerberg expected, because he knew all along.
Right. He knew all along. That's why he played these guys for fools. Hello. Right.
Exactly. So if you're an app developer and you make a living by selling revenue within a game, and you make a lot of your revenue and you earn a lot of your customer acquisitions from using Facebook advertising, you don't care. Pandemic, elections, boycott, that doesn't matter to you. You feed your family based on Facebook advertising. So not only are you going to continue to do so, but as P&G pulls their budgets away and as Starbucks pulls their budgets away, all of a sudden you're campaigns are becoming incrementally more profitable, which means you're increasing the amount of budget that you do. And you factor that out across hundreds of thousands of advertisers that are spending money on Facebook, then that's a significant amount of money.
Yeah, when I first saw this, I have 2 points on this. When I first saw in the news that there was a list, they created a website, there was a list of, like, you know, 15, 20 large companies. It was Verizon, North Face, a few other big ones boycotting Facebook ads. My initial reaction, I remember speaking to David that same day or the day after, we both had the same initial gut reaction, was like, and like they were sort of saying, like they had this meeting with Mark Zuckerberg and they didn't really, you know, they sort of pandered a little bit, but they didn't like kowtow to the demands that these bigger companies were making. And I'm not making any commentary on the issue itself. I'm just talking about the business dynamic itself. It was like my instinctual reaction was like, Zuckerberg knows what he's doing. And he knows that it's not North Face and Verizon that has made Facebook the second largest advertising company on planet Earth, right behind Google. Like it's 95% of their income is coming from small businesses selling small products and being wildly successful. And I think this was the ideal outcome, because do you know who drives up the auction price and hurts the ability for a small business? Just like Patrick said, it's Verizon and it's North Face just throwing discriminatory budget, See, North Face, when they run Facebook ads, the KPI that the KPI that the director of marketing has to report up to his boss is how many video views did we get? What was the reach? Right, these are vanity metrics that make a big brand look good.
Right, not how many things that I sell so that I can feed my family, to Patrick's point.
Exactly. And when they pulled out, like Patrick said, all the small businesses, their costs became a little bit less, they became more profitable, and they fueled more budget, and Facebook had a better quarter than ever before in the middle, not despite of the boycott, because of the boycott.
So let's talk about though some of the things that led to the boycott. You know, as you know, you and I did talk about it like literally within minutes of the announcement. And you know, I was unpopular amongst some of my colleagues because I called it out for what I thought it was from the very beginning, a waste of time. And you know, it was sort of cynical in a sense, as far as I was concerned, because it came during a quarter when it was almost irrelevant anyways, and nobody stayed out all that long, or few stayed out all that long, to be fair. And so I just never understood it. And, you know, it felt more that it should be like, what can you actually do to educate people, just not to share that crap? But nobody wants to go there, because then that depresses everything for everybody else. So that becomes like a bigger issue. So let's talk about though the issues, the hate, the bias, the posts that show up in you know, against things that are bad for your brand. Where are clients standing with that today?
Oh, that's a good topic.
I gotta be honest. I will say,
give me good stuff, guys.
I have seen fewer comments on that specifically within the last year than I did after the 2016 election. Because I think that clients now either believe that there's nothing that they can do to not align themselves with those sorts of messages, or like be shown at the same side of them, or that it'll work itself out naturally. I mean, I remember there was a big uproar, you know, a couple years back when a lot of display ads are being shown on like ultra right wing conservative news networks. So that was like, we spent a lot of our time kind of looking at areas like that clients wouldn't want to align themselves with. But it's certainly a concern. And it's something that you basically have to rely on the platforms themselves to regulate, because ultimately if you're trying to drive profit and you're individually handpicking these managed placements with, whether it be on, you know, for YouTube placements or for display ads, it becomes extremely hard.
I want to step back for a second to educate the audience listener, because there might be confusion. And this is where the clients were getting confused. Back in the old days, before Patrick's time and my time, when you bought display, although in the beginning we did used to buy display like this a little bit, where we would call up, we went to visit Bloomberg once on behalf of a client and we struck a deal. But you would pick out a publisher, right? So Bloomberg is a publisher. The New York Times is a publisher. Breitbart is a publisher. The Ben Shapiro podcast is a publisher. You would choose a publisher that you felt your audience might be, the client's audience might be hanging out with or reading content from. You would call them or email them and you would say, we want to buy 1 million impressions. We want to do a homepage takeover. We want to sponsor this section. They give you a price, you negotiate it, you buy it, and you send them the ads.
Right. The way media was bought for 1,000 years.
Yeah. Now, what's happening now is different. Now, the same client comes to us, like to an agency, that says, we want to buy display impressions on publishers. So we don't choose publishers. We buy data. And we say, first we understand the insight into your audience. Who are these people really? What do they want? What problem in their life, what frustration is your product or your service solving for them? What are they like? Who do they hang out with? What's their tribal identity? That information, the insight, manual insight plus insight purchased through market research companies and market research surveys, is fed into Google system, into Facebook system. And Facebook and Google, not personally, but through machine learning, will buy the media from the publishers in real time as a page is loaded. So here's what was happening. And oftentimes these are retargeting impressions. Oftentimes the Google and Facebook, they're choosing, we should show an ad on Breitbart or we should show an ad on the New York Times, because we know this is your customer. We know that this person was just on your website.
Right. So, well, clients, they're following you. Right. So make that point. Is that, I was just going to say that. That's,
but here's
that's
what happened.
A critical issue. It's not the ad. It's not that that brand has bought an ad in a bad place. It's that Isaac went to a bad place, if
exactly.
you will.
And no, so let me walk this through exactly. So we would have clients, right? This, and Patrick's right. There was a huge uptick in these requests from clients after the 2016 election. It has gradually died down. But we had clients emailing us saying, look, here's a list of 100 websites we don't want our ads showing on. Or we would have an email from a client say, I can't believe it. I received a culinary school in the city. That's the client, for example. That's the advertiser. They sell culinary classes. We get an email, a screenshot, said, I can't believe it. One of our students or one of our prospects was sent us this ad, and they're angry that we are supporting this right-wing publisher, this far-right publisher that has hate speech on their website. We knew what was going on, is that the customer was on the advertiser's website checking out the culinary courses. The next day, the customer voluntarily went to read an article on that site. And they, when they see that ad appear, they think the advertiser is specifically purchasing or supporting this publisher, whereas no, we're just trying to follow you around the internet. We're only here because you're here. If you weren't here and it was somebody else, that ad wouldn't be there.
Exactly.
So that was a really interesting conversation we have with clients. And then oftentimes there was pushback. Oftentimes the clients would say, no matter what, we don't want it getting out. And fine, like we as an agency respect the wishes of the client in that case. And there are ways within Facebook and Google to specifically exclude publishers from a campaign, which we would have to do manually. We would have sometimes lists of hundreds of websites to exclude.
So what should my strategy be? Right, so I'm coming into the market. I'm a small, medium business owner. I'm selling something that I think people would really like. What should my strategy be? How do I start?
Give me an example. What are you selling? What's your fictitious product?
I'm selling boysenberry flavored yogurt that has a probiotic benefit and CBD.
All right, so that's a great product.
It makes your stomach feel better and it clears your head. Like, think about that. It's pretty cool.
In fact, that product
maybe afterwards we'll talk about this. Could be something.
Yeah. I don't know. You asked me, that product sells itself. But if you were coming to us as an agency, and I think this is like, I think our prospects and clients appreciate this about us. And they because these conversations tend not to happen with agencies that they've had experience with, is we first talk about the economics of the business. Like, okay, you have all this, you have a great product, you have a probiotic, you have the berry flavor, and you have CBD. We're going to talk all about that and about what problems you're solving and how great you are and the improvements you're going to bring to your customers' lives. But first, like, what does it cost? How much do you, what is your cost to create each individual unit of yogurt? Are we selling to retailers? Are we selling directly off the website? So let's say we're selling directly off the website. What is the cost of running this website? What are your software costs? What are your overhead costs? How much? And then that discussion really tells us one thing. What is the most we could spend on advertising to acquire a customer who buys a one yogurt pack or a 12 yogurt pack or a yogurt subscription? And the one big X factor or wrench in that equation often is the client's individual goals. Because you might say, listen, I'm investor backed. They're not looking for high profit margins. We just need to take market share away from Chobani right now. Right. So it's like, our cost to produce and ship a yogurt is $2. It's okay. Our investors are okay with spending $3 to acquire a customer because that means that's market share from Chobani and that's growth. That's goal. That might be one goal. If you're a smaller operation without any investor capital and this is your income, it's like, don't sell them for more than $1.50. We got to make 50 cents per unit sold. Once we have that information, we sort of have like a navigational heading. Then we could start figuring out what are the viable options. I might know right away that bottom of the funnel Google search is too expensive, right? Because the clicks themselves are going to be in that dollar range, $1.50 range, and you'd have to have an 80 to 90% conversion rate to hit your profitability benchmark. So I don't need to spend $10,000 on Google to tell you it's not going to work. I know based on the first conversations about the economic dynamic that you need for this to work, that's not an advertising platform that might work. However, a good creative strategy on Facebook, which is broader, hitting more people. This is yogurt, CBD, it's a wide market. Then that's when we talk, what's the creative strategy? What's the messaging that could bring virality to it? What type of ad could we show that will spark either something a little controversial or something funny, some emotional spark? Because when you're running these ads, you have to understand you're selling to individuals, but individuals share things that are interesting or emotional or get a little bit of a rise out of them. And the ads that have worked the
best. Let's hold it for a second. Hold on a second right there. So let's just talk about the creativity that goes into everything you've just said. So there's creativity in understanding the economics of the product. There's creativity in understanding the audience and the reaction of the audience and general metrics of click-throughs and whatever, and buying, if you will. Then there's creativity in the messaging and the delivery. Yes? And then creativity in the offer. What else?
There's creativity in analyzing the data and extracting actual insight, because every agency gets data sets and they all look the same. They're all spreadsheets, right? They're all reports. But it's like, can you look at this and tell me what's going on? Why did we only sell to women? Why did we only sell from this ad and not that ad? Like what? Like what's the actual reason this happened? And that's when you become a better, that's when you become a more compelling advertiser.
So there's a, again, just because creativity from the other side, but there is a complete chain of creativity here from beginning to end, from creation of the product to my drinking the product and having a better stomach and a clear head, that is inextricably linked from, and if any one of those pieces doesn't work or isn't the ultimate in terms of the creativity that I can put into it, then the chain breaks.
Yes. And to add to that, I think that there's this incorrect idea that people have about right brain and left brain, where you have, and I used to believe this, where you have like data people and then you have creatives. And that's just not the way it works in reality, especially in the advertising space. What you really need is somebody who understands data, is data literate, but can add creativity on top of that to come up with interesting hypotheses, because ultimately we think we have all the data in the world, but we really don't. And so kind of to summarize what Isaac had spoken about as far as our approach, we would look at business goals, but then it goes down to who is the audience and where are they? Then it goes down to what is the creative message? So what are we getting across? What are the key value propositions? And therefore, what sort of platform should we be advertising on? For your product, the yogurt, Spotify might be a great place to advertise. That's where your target market might be hanging out. But really compelling ads for a yogurt, for a food product, it's probably really difficult to do that with an audio Spotify ad. So we would leverage video, we would leverage more imagery, and we would then focus on those sorts of platforms. Then the third element of it is attribution. How can we get an understanding that any of these sales can actually be attributed to the ad campaigns? And it's not as simple as people would love it to be. So there are times where you have to get really creative about, well, you know, we're looking at, we ran a TV ad buy, and we're looking at an increase in site traffic in the 10-minute increments after those TV ad buys. And we're going to take a cohort analysis of those people and then measure the average conversion rate of people that came to the site from that. And that's how we're going to come up with our own attribution solution. So you have to really be creative in terms of like point A to point B and all those individual problems you meet along the way, because it's not as linear as people like it to be.
Creativity from all sides, not just from the other side. So Patrick, let's talk about your book. So dear audience, Patrick has written a book. It's called Join or Die: Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation. And shameless self-promotion, it has two brilliant forewords, one written by Isaac and the other written by me. I was very proud and I thank you. I was honored that you asked me to write a foreword to it. But tell us a little about the book, because what you do is it's called Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation. One might think that it's all about automation, and yet it's not. And just hearing you talk now, it's very clear that your approach to all of this is much more eclectic and much broader and much more creative than anybody I think would think.
Thank you, I appreciate it. And your foreword's fantastic. I mean, it's a huge asset to the book, and for everyone, it's a key important piece, because if people don't get past those first couple pages, they're not going to get to what I actually wrote. So I think you did a great job. I think
you glued those pages together, folks. Like, I'm not sure.
So the book, a minute ago, I spoke about, you know, how we're validating where our audience is, right? The reason that Facebook and Google are the two most popular digital advertising platforms is because whatever you're selling, whether it's yogurt or software as a service or whatever, chances are your audience is on both of those platforms, which is why the majority of our clients' spend is focused on those areas. So now it's like, okay, well, a lot of these companies operate on these platforms. What's happening within those platforms? And there's a big shift right now to leveraging more machine learning and automation in making changes and bidding decisions that otherwise used to be done by the advertising agencies themselves. Now, this sounds great, because if you had never heard of any of this before, and I had come to you and said, hey, look, Facebook is an incredible platform, and part of what makes it so great is that a lot of the individual decisions on which ads to buy and how much to bid for that is automated based on your goals. And therefore, it allows you more time to focus on solving higher level business problems. And you would say, that's incredible. Sign me up. Let's get Facebook ads off the ground today. However, there's been this really, really interesting dynamic taking place in the digital advertising industry, where a lot of agencies and their clients have pushed back against automation. My take on that is because they're afraid of the technology. And I can say that because I've experienced this fear myself. When we were a younger agency, we used to push back against automation because we had this assumption that, like, Google's going to automate everything, and then no one's going to need agencies like us, and we'll be out of a job. So naturally, we put out propaganda saying that automation is bad. 10 years later, when automation is actually the best thing that has ever come to advertising, and we've figured out the value that we add on top of it, we're still not getting buy-in from the rest of the marketing community. So therefore, I've been really diving into this topic, and I've been an advocate for automation and trying to teach people about how it really works and what it really means for the last couple of years. And it kind of culminated with this book that was published in November. It's only been a month now, which is crazy, but it was published last month. It's brand new, but it talks about what automation really is, what it can do. It talks about, it really dives into, like, the how it works and how to leverage it to draw success from your campaigns. And then the third part of it, the back half of the book, is really about what does advertising look like in this modern era? How can agencies prep themselves, and how should they hire, and how should they think about growing and think about different platforms in this new age? So that's essentially the book. I'm really excited about it.
As am I, and I really endorse it fully, and you're going to learn a lot. What can I say? So guys, look, every time we talk, I learn a lot from AdVenture, whether I'm talking to Isaac or Patrick or any of your other partners and co-conspirators. You guys are great. I think performance marketing often gets a bad rap, because I think it does get a rap that it is all about strictly automation. It's all about programmatic. And doesn't have much creativity to it. And yet, clearly that's not the case, just listening to you. So I thank you for sharing that with us. And any last words?
Yeah, I'll just say a couple quick last things on the creativity side. I think it's so important, especially since the title of this series is Creativity from the Other Side. I also like creativity from all sides. I personally don't have a background in data and statistics. It's not my thing. I sort of fooled myself at some point over the years, but I started off in high school. Well, I was always into art, and I was drawing like very realistic pencil portraits throughout my high school career. After that, I got into painting and abstract painting, and I founded our agency because I wanted to have a website for my artwork instead of having to schlep it around on tied in bungee cords to the top of a borrowed SUV to art festivals. And I was selling paintings, and it was great. And I thought, like, well, website and technology, and it's going to cheapen everything, and I don't understand it. And But that, long story short, got me down a wormhole of internet advertising from my art. And
so creativity led to your career as a performance marketer.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And I for a long time I pigeonholed myself as, like, I sort of felt that I was a creative, more the creative side, and I didn't have a head for numbers or for these performance things. But if I wanted to grow this company and be in the trenches, so to speak, with our first group of hires, I had to know this stuff. I had to get myself a basic education. And I have a master's degree in industrial psychology, which included a course in statistics. Although I was skiing for most of the exams, and I don't think I paid as much attention as I should have, but I there's plenty of online opportunities for learning, and I forced myself to learn a lot of this stuff. And I was able to teach myself concepts and formulas and the ability to analyze a spreadsheet more so than I ever believed myself capable. On the flip side, I believe that there's a great degree of creativity in the non-conventional forms of creativity. People think, like, we have a woman in our office who, she's not the one who's gonna write the winning headline for an ad, but you give her any data set. And after you've shown it to 10 data engineers, and she will look at it, and in 20 minutes later, she will give you an insight into what this table is showing you that no one else is able to find. And she wouldn't call herself creative, but I call her creative. I think that's an unbelievably
creative. It's incredibly creative.
Yeah. And I think people have to be open to a wider and more holistic definition of the word creative. It's
something that can't be taught, but it can be learned with practice. And I think looking at a data set and saying, what is the hypothesis? How can I add some creativity here and sharpen that skill? Is something that if you're conscious of, you can improve over time.
Yeah. And so I was, and I think this point is somewhat illustrated. I was recently listening to Patrick hates it when I go off on tangents like this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I was listening to a masterclass by Aaron Sorkin recently. I happen to love masterclass. Aaron Sorkin, who's a famous screenwriter, he wrote A Few Good Men, which was actually a play first. He started off with a playwright, then became a movie with Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson. He wrote the Steve Jobs movie, The West Wing, recently The Trial of Chicago 7, which was very good. To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a play on Broadway now. He wrote, so he's a great writer. And he talks about dialogue. And he says that people sometimes teach or say that this, you know, you have to write dialogue for the screen in the same way people would talk. And he said, that's never been my thing. Like, if you listen to the dialogue in his plays, it's overly dramatized. No one talks that way. It's not how people speak. And he said, when Picasso or Rembrandt, when they painted a scene, they weren't painting photorealism. It was a representation of a scene that's expressed in an artistic form through the eyes of the artist. And that's what's special about it. Like, it wouldn't be as cool. Like, a lot of people could paint photorealism. But when you're looking at a Rembrandt or a Monet or the scene, you're seeing something expressive and different than the scene itself. And that's what makes it heightened. And that's what makes it artistic. And he applied the same idea to dialogue. When he writes dialogue between characters, he writes it in a way where normal people don't speak that way. So I think that's the same thing applied to what we do. If you have data from a campaign and it all looks the same, it is what it is. These are the numbers, these are the dimensions, these are the metrics. But someone with a creative, expressive mind, this woman who I'm talking about at our office, looks at it through a lens of creativity, through a lens of some sort of distortion, some sort of paradigm where the light refracts in a different way. And she's like, here's an insight into why the data is what it is. And someone else, a different artist, might not have had that insight. It's an interpretation. And I think that's really where the core of creativity is to me. And lastly on the idea of creativity, with digital advertising, David, you're right. We have a bad rap because people think it's all just technology driven. It's just buttons and it's binary code and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's you are selling to another person. I have a product. I have a service. I have something that I'd like you to pay for. It will, no matter how much technology you layer on to make certain aspects of this more efficient and more effective, you have to be able to reach the heart and mind of the consumer if you want to convince them and influence them that what you're selling is worth their hard-earned dollar. And advertisers who fail to see that or neglect that part of the process, the whole thing crumbles. Because at the end of the day, I got something to sell and I need to convince you. And that all is in messaging, and it's in the value of the product, it's in your service of your customers. It's in understanding the market. And that's a really crucial component of it, which sometimes is lost. The technology used properly helps do that at scale and more effectively and more efficiently. And that's the edge digital agencies can provide, as long as they're also psychologically in tune with the feelings of the consumer, of the customer, of the market. And lastly, I would just say to David personally, the growth of our company and our agency and the excitement we have about this is really in large part due to your friendship, your guidance, the advice you've given us. And I think Adventure Media itself is a much, much better agency, a much stronger group of people, certainly a lot more excited because of the influence that you've had on me personally and on everyone else here. And I want to express just a great deal of appreciation to you for all that you've given our company.
Well, thank you. That's embarrassing, but I appreciate it. And you know, I hope it's true. So there you go. But I will say, guys, that I do learn a lot from you. And I hope that everyone who's watching listened carefully. Like, you wonder where our industry is going. And it always, you know, those who follow my writing and who listen to the things that I say in presentations and some of the interviews that I've been doing, know that I have this view of, why do we beat up our own industry? Why are we an industry that continues to beat ourselves up and wonder, where are we going? Is it dead? Is it not dead? Like, it's a lot of crap. Listen to Adventure Media, right? Leaders in performance marketing, leaders in data, who talk about touching the hearts and minds. Nothing could be more important to our industry. Nothing could be more important to our creativity. Nothing could be more important to our future than remembering that at the core of everything that we do is touching the hearts and minds of the consumer.
Thanks so much for listening to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I'm Isaac Gradansky, your host. We were joined today by Patrick Gilbert, Adventure Media's executive director, and David Sable, former global CEO of Young & Rubicamfer, an inspiring and scintillating conversation. And if you haven't done it already, get yourself a copy of Join or Die: Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, written by Patrick Gilbert, forwarded by myself and David Sable. It's available on Amazon in hardcover, in paperback, in Kindle. Join or Die: Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation is a masterclass in the strategies and the techniques that we use to uncover incredible profitability and success in our clients' campaigns. Check it out. Join or Die: Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation. And we'll see you guys and talk to you all next week.